Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business, sponsored this week by Checkpoint Software and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting. On this week's show, we're taking a look at all things wireless with Neil Wise. Neil's a genuine, certified wireless nut. Tutorial attendees at OSCERT's annual conference may have attended his wireless workshop, which included a trip around Queensland's Gold Coast in the Warbus. And I spoke to Neil about that, and I get the impression he found taking a bunch of cops war driving in a big bus quite funny. Anyway, he'll be along soon to talk about messing with Bluetooth and 802.11. Did you know that you can get most workstations equipped with Bluetooth to basically provision a NATed IP to a mobile device connecting to it? Neither did I, but a lot of what Anil has to say is food for thought. He's also taken a look at HD Moore's work on integrating Karma and Metasploit and found some interesting results there, so you'll want to stay tuned for this interview. In this week's sponsor interview, we'll chat with Checkpoint's Steve McDonald all about always-on SSL VPNs. The jury seems out on whether or not they're actually a good idea, but guess what? Customers want them, and we all know the customer gets what the customer wants, for better or for worse. But first, as always, it's time for this week's news headlines with our good friend at ZDNet Australia, Mania Katadia. So, Morn, now, look, I hate to do this even on a security show, but it just wouldn't be the IT media unless we had a story about the iPhone to lead in with.
Well, they did just launch it, so I guess we're allowed.
They did, and security guys, like, hello, listeners, I know you all love your iPhones, because I go to conferences and I see everyone using them. So, you know, here is the iPhone 3G story. It's official. Apple is launching the 3G network compatible iPhone in Australia in, what is it, the 11th of July?
That's right, yep, 11th of July, we should be seeing it at last.
Now, I love this story that you guys ran, which came from CNET, came off the CNET feed, which is not really about all of the wonderful features in the iPhone, but about all of the really basic stuff that didn't actually make it into the device.
It's amazing how many, such simple things, which we so desperately needed, and they're just not in there, and it's a bit strange, really.
Yeah, well, no MMS messaging, which I think is a bit of a, you know, unusual thing to not have in a, you know, highly capable phone.
How many phones don't have that facility?
There's the iPhone.
I think it's right there on its end at the top of the list, really.
Yeah, yeah. But this is my favorite. There's no copy and paste.
Again, I mean, that was... How difficult can it be to put copy and paste on the damn thing? I don't know. Yeah, you've used an iPod Touch or an iPhone or something before,
haven't you? Played around with one, you know, when I was drunk, and I was like, hey, let me use that. But it was, you know, I just can't believe that there's no copy and paste. Yeah. I mean, you'd think that would be, included feature.
Pretty annoying. But yeah, it's not there again. So hopefully, there'll probably be an application to add it at some point. But no, it's not there.
Well, and the other things like the Bluetooth, lack of Bluetooth profile, so you can only use a Bluetooth headset. So you can't use like the Apple keyboard or anything like that in case you actually want to type text into it. You can't actually use it as a Bluetooth modem, as a Bluetooth equipped modem to use with your laptop or anything like that. So look, as wonderful as the iPhone is, really you're talking about a computer that can't copy and paste.
It's a pretty basic feature.
I don't care if you can fit it in your pocket. If you can't copy and paste with it, it's just a silly, silly gadget. But I'm probably still going to get one, so I should probably shut up. So there you go, guys. Yeah. I know you've all prided yourselves on being the first people in the country with iPhones because you cracked them because you're all very clever, but yep, the mouth-breathing consumers are all about to have them soon, and they're a lot cheaper.
Can somebody please add copy and paste to it and then send me the link on how to
do it? If someone can come up with that hack, that'd be really handy. Now, this is interesting because I remember when this tender actually came out and it's actually launched, which is the federal government has launched a new security alert service for small business and home users aimed at helping Australians.
This is very interesting. They're partnered with OSCERT to do this, and it's kind of like, you know, from what I get, the impression I get is it's an OSCERT alert service for smaller businesses, which is kind of an interesting move.
Well, it is. I mean, I'm kind of skeptical as to whether or not this is going to work. I mean, I've seen the website. It's not pretty.
Then again, nor is the OSCERT website.
No. It's consumer information, pretty much, you know, you can think of it as security for dummies.
Yeah, do you know how much they're charging for this?
It's free.
It's free because it says subscription based. So I guess you just sign up, right?
And give it's free and it's a good idea. But I mean, I'm really skeptical because, you know, I don't know if you saw Dan Klein's presentation at OSCERT. You can actually go to itradio.com.au/OSCERT08 and it's the most recently posted presentation. So you can download it there. But, you know, he was saying that to the average person, you know, they don't realize that using Internet Explorer 3 on Windows 98 is the problem. Do you know what I mean? Because they're just so not across the issues that to actually create awareness in a user in the first place that they actually need to go and subscribe to alerts, I just don't think this is going to work. I don't think it's going to really do much.
I think the biggest problem here is that the people who actually know about the site and will go and visit it are the ones who are probably quite safe anyway.
To most people, you know, safety online, it's being jeopardized by the hackers, the bad guys, right? Mm. And there's nothing they can do. They're just ordinary people who use their computers. There's nothing they can do to prevent these evil overlords of the internet from taking control of their computers and, like, you know, disabling the brakes on their car.
Yeah, this is it. It's all about education, and the people who this is going to be aimed at, I don't think they're going to get there. But maybe if, like, you know, the Federal Department of Broadband Communications and the digital economy, if they're going to really push it and throw some money behind it, maybe there are more people who will find out about it.
Actually changed the department name to...
Yeah, they did that at the election.
Oh, my God. The Federal Department of Broadband Communications and the digital economy.
That's right.
Oh, well. Great. The digital economy, is it on or off?
Hey, come on, at least the arts aren't included in it anymore.
Yeah, yeah, we used to have, for listeners who aren't aware, we used to have the Department of Communications, Information Technology and the Arts, which was an odd pairing, man. Come on, that's a little bit strange. Okay, now this is a very interesting story here that Liam Tung, your journalist Liam Tung, has written up, which is that spammers are taking advantage of Google's free analytics service to track the performance of spam campaigns and boost their business. And I think this is a brilliant idea on their part.
Well, obviously, I mean, you know, they're just businessmen at the end of the day, and they've got to get some metrics here to show that their spam list is the best spam list going, and what better to use than Google's own analytical service, which they can do that, and then they can go up to their prospective salespeople and say, hey guys, check this out, you can buy this, and this is exactly what you'll get from the service.
Yeah, no, I can see them going into their little spam boardroom with a bunch of printed PDFs that have been auto-generated from the Google Analytics service and saying, yes, we have achieved objective by infecting with malware these 700,000 people in these particular countries using these browsers.
Hey, you've been sharpening up your accent in Moscow, huh?
No, I was in Thailand. I'm going to St. Petersburg soon, but I haven't been to Russia.
You're practicing for that then?
Practicing to speak like malware writer.
well, apparently the message lads have been saying that they've seen this being used by Canadian Pharmacy. Oh, that's what it's called, the shop online. It's called Canadian Pharmacy.
Yeah, it's probably owned by someone in Hakistan, you know.
Well, yeah, totally.
Who knows? But it is a really fascinating thing. And there's another somewhat related story there. And this is all, of course, coming out of Message Labs, mm-hmm. who've, you know, really come up with the info on which these stories are based. And there's another interesting piece here below that, which is that some of these spammer guys are actually exploiting email forwarding features offered by many recruitment firms, which automatically send resumes to customers when a new applicant uploads their CV. So, you know, we're seeing some really innovative attacks on behalf of the spammers these days. They're actually coming up with some pretty interesting stuff.
This is really, really interesting move by them. Now, we've talked about this before. You know, if you're a HR manager and you get a CV, then what are you going to do? And if you've signed up to something like Seek, which is our local Australian, one of their biggest recruitment sites, then you've already signed up for alerts, and then you get an alert saying there's a CV, then you're going to open it. There is no reason why you will not open that. And, of course, these guys are using that, and they're sending an infected file along with the document, which is an RTF document.
Yeah, no, it is. Look, it's just an all-round interesting idea, so...
Scary,
well,
I find it.
Yeah, good on them. I mean, seriously, like, you know, we've got to expect that, you know, we're going to be able to innovate on the so-called good side, you know, and be able to come up with ways to shut down this stuff. But, you know, I've got to say, I'm quite impressed with a lot of the stuff that these guys are doing on the bad side. I mean, they keep finding more ways to do evil stuff. And look, one of them is in those same two stories there that you can read on zdnet.com.au/news, is that people are using Google Docs to forward spam, because instead of sending a URL to a specific thing on a custom server, they're actually sending a link to a Google Docs page, which goes straight through the spam filters and things like that. So they're taking advantage of trust models. You know, they're taking advantage of auto forwarding. They're taking advantage of Google's own analytics to track their success and better hone their tactics. And, you know, I just think it's I think it's pretty fascinating.
I think it's brilliant. It means that me and you are going to have a job for years to come.
Yeah. God bless. Now, look, in this next story, a jailbreak type of crack similar to the one developed for the iPhone has been developed for Symbian. And this is interesting because it's the latest version of Symbian that runs on the Nokia N95, right? And what it enables you to do is run unsigned applications.
That's right. According to F-Secure, it's Patrick Runald. He says it allows an application to do things to the device which it shouldn't be able to do. That's like using a network connection without a user prompt. Now, you know, Symbian, this version is supposed to be ultra secure, and it's definitely more secure than other things like Windows and other things out there. But this is showing cracks in it.
Okay, look, while this is an interesting story, I have to say, you remember last year in December, we had this flurry of press releases from every Tom, Dick and Harry, and I mean every single vendor, yeah, saying that 2008 was going to be the year of mobile. You remember that?
I do remember that. I remember, okay, Gartner saying a few years ago that 2008, okay, will be a major mobile virus as
but
well.
But you remember last year it was acute,
yep,
right? It was,
yep,
acute. Everyone was saying it was going to be the year of mobile. Okay, where is it? Come on, show me.
Where is
this epidemic of mobile threats? Look, I understand that people have to do certain things to lock down mobile devices for compliance reasons, but in terms of this, they really heavily implied that there was going to be mass poning. There was going to, yep, be mass ponage of mobile devices. It hasn't happened. And they've all just shut up very, very quietly, you know.
Yeah,
just,
nobody said anything.
Away.
But then again, there is still, like, you know, 5.5 months of the year left. Who,
yeah,
can tell?
Yeah, no, mate, I don't think it's coming for another few years yet. I mean, I think there's going to be all of these nifty little attacks for Symbian and stuff, but until we've got people regularly engaging with data networks, we could start seeing some stuff. But, yeah, look, I think that was a premature declaration that 2008 was going to be the year of, you know, mobile security disasters. And,
yep,
yeah, I think we can safely say that was spin.
Absolutely, and I think a lot of the people who were saying all of that did actually have some sort of mobile security application to flog, so
it
was obviously where that was coming from.
Of course they did, because they've stopped selling, you know, stopped pushing identity management really hard, and it turns out this year's big hyped solution is DLP, and, you know, DLP is useful in some sort of circumstances, and it's really good to prevent people accidentally doing the wrong thing, but of course it's the latest cash cow for the vendors, you know, and I guess they were all pushing their mobile suites before they realized they could get an easier sale out of DLP.
I guess so.
Now, this is an interesting piece that is actually quite old. Sorry, but I mean, we didn't get to do the news last week because I was off in Bangkok. But Apple has published a Mac OS X security guide, which is a 240-page document. And it's mostly for people who spend most of their time at the command line. And I know that there would be a lot of OS X users listening who mightn't have heard yet that guide's out. And I've heard some people talking about it, and they say it's pretty good.
Yeah, apparently it helps you lock down the system to protect against unauthorized access by people with physical access as well.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's just about locking down user accounts and things like that and stopping local privilege escalation bugs and things like that. So, you know, it's just a really good comprehensive guide for people who really know what they're doing. And there are a lot of Mac users, I'd imagine, who would benefit from that. So.
Absolutely. And then there is a warning there. Only technically adept users should bother.
That's it for this week's news, Mon.
Oh, well, it's been another blast.
It's been a blast, as always. Okay, Munir the Munster Katadia, thank you very much for coming on to Risky Business again.
You're welcome, mate. Talk to you next week.
ZDNet Australia's editor, Munir Katadia there. And most of those stories came from zdnet.com.au/news. Up next, it's time for part one of our feature interview with Neil Wise of assurance.com.au in Melbourne. Neil's one of those guys who was born holding a 10 dBi antenna. To him, Pringles aren't a source of oh-so-oily nutrition, but he knows their packaging makes a great antenna. Neil's presented his wireless insecurity series over 50 times at a stack of conferences in the Asia-Pacific region, including multiple talks and tutorials at AusCert, the Australasian Policing Association and High-Tech Crime Centre conferences. He also lectures at Deakin, Monash and RMIT universities. Back in the day, Neil was an instructor for Foundstone's Ultimate Hacking course. That course was even taught at Black Hat in Las Vegas. So I guess that's a long-form way of saying Neil really knows his shit. In this interview, we talk about the latest Bluetooth bug. It's Microsoft Patch Tuesday in the US right now, and one of the patches is for a critical flaw in the Bluetooth stack. We also talk about Bluetooth security in general, as well as 802.11 security. So, Neil, let's get started. Is this Bluetooth bug that Microsoft's currently patching a big deal?
It's interesting because we've seen some similar things with wireless device drivers last couple of years. And you know, obviously, if you can get some kind of capability to abuse the driver, I mean, the driver for the device is going to operate with some privilege. So if there's a capability to abuse the Bluetooth stack itself or the driver for a Bluetooth interface on a system, then you know there's an opportunity to do something with privilege through that system. So
well, this is a bug in the stack, which means that you know it's not hardware dependent. It's you know you we'll get on to talking about your Bluetooth ward driving rig in a minute, but you could pretty much drive that thing through the middle of the Sydney CBD, mass poning anything with Bluetooth turned on and Windows running.
Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding of it too. At this point, the vulnerability is just listed as critical, and there's a vague description of Microsoft's version of what critical is, of course. But it certainly, if there's something that's and it uses the abstracted like framework layer, yeah, and it's a fairly widespread thing. And what is of greatest concern to me, and this is what I see in my sort of day-to-day world, is notebook SOEs, where there's you know a Bluetooth support that's been committed for devices. In systems, it's going to potentially mean that there's a widespread issue. You can sit in any corporate office and you can sniff around and see discoverable Bluetooth devices. And even if you can't see devices that are made to be discoverable, you can find them using parallel scanning of Bluetooth hardware addresses. So.
Well, lucky it's patched, right?
Yes.
And I guess the other problem with this one is like is that you can't actually IPS or firewall a Bluetooth bug.
No, but the thing is you can have your Bluetooth turned off when you're not using it, and that's one of the main sort of fundamental issues with the technology is that it's hard to it leaves it up to the user to do that for the most part, and they may have a big switch on the system or something like that to turn wireless on and off, but which usually would include Bluetooth, the way that they sort of simplify things, but users don't know better than that. Like, it's too hard. It's a difficult concept to explain to them.
Well, no, your average mouth-breathing user out there is not really going to bother with switching stuff on and off because they're going to be thinking, why the hell would I turn it off? That way I can't use it, right?
That's right. And at some level, I understand that because my example for that is that I like to go to I'm a good Australian. I go to the footy. But I also like to whip my phone out and look for discoverable devices while I'm sitting there. and I did it on Friday night, and from where I was sitting, I could see 50 devices from my phone. 50 devices from my phone that are discoverable. You know, I mean, you get a nice view of everybody, but, you know, yeah, so it's a real problem. And I guess for me, it's again the people walking around, you know, talking away on their Bluetooth headsets, you know, and just never shutting up, and you know any place I'm at the mall, you know, and I like to refer to those people as mickheads, basically, as my.
It's the shopping centre in Australia, by the way, Neil. I need to tell you this so you may assimilate more appropriately.
I try. So.
Yeah. But look, over the years, we've heard varying degrees of hysteria about Bluetooth and about whether or not it is in fact an inherently insecure protocol. Weren't there some problems that came out with the standard itself where they said, well, we're never going to be able to resolve this, things involving authentication and, you know, and whatnot?
There were basically in the initial pairing process between a device and the system that you're pairing with, there's some information that's exchanged that if that kind of conversation can be observed, that can be used later to help identify where you would find the members of the pair and to be able to attack those devices. So that was something that the recommendation from the vendors basically was that you needed to pair in private, you know, which is interesting. It's just everything sounds euphemistic in IT. So
pair in private, yeah. Yes. So really, you can actually use Bluetooth, assuming that you've paired your device properly. You can actually use Bluetooth without. You know, Munir Katadia, who's a regular, you know, our regular news guest on the show, he said that he had a guy do a demo for him when he was still working in London, and this guy came into the office and just started pulling photos off Munir's camera phone. You know,
there was a whole class of vulnerabilities that were identified by primarily by Adam Laurie that were related to the OBEX vulnerabilities, and there's certain classes of, I think it was mostly Symbian based phones of a certain era. That allowed without authentication the ability to retrieve address book, calendar, and other data like that. I think the most the biggest example of that was an attack that somebody had done sitting in a cafe just near the British Parliament, and they were using a directional antenna, and they were attacking phones inside of the Parliament building. So
nice.
Yeah.
So I guess these people who say that Bluetooth is absolutely inherently insecure, you know, they're only half right, aren't they? You can actually use it with a reasonable degree of confidence.
You can, but you have less of an opportunity to know whether something is or isn't going wrong. And you know, with conventional 802.11 wireless, if you're looking in the right place, and no users are, it's going to be at the access point or the management sort of component of the solution.
Well, that said, I mean, I don't know too many security guys who use Bluetooth keyboards.
True. I don't, and it's certainly that, and worse than that, I guess, you know, infrared or proprietary RF keyboards. People certainly don't use those. The issues of years past of, you know, of those devices, you know, two of them of the same kind being in use in the same area, and, you know, keystrokes appearing on the other person's computer from the other
device. I don't think anyone would argue that they're, like, strongly encrypted or anything like that, but how's the Bluetooth encryption? Can you actually do, like, key logging on someone's Bluetooth keyboard? Or I'm just wondering how vulnerable the standard Bluetooth crypto is to that sort of nastiness.
Well, there'd be two levels of that, you know, there may be a way to do something within the Bluetooth protocol, but not that I'm currently aware of, but there certainly would be, as with any keyboard, the opportunity to introduce something at that side, or the keyboard side of it, or just the concept of attack of you know, observing the traffic and trying to work out exactly what the user's doing based on the rate of transmission. That's a sentence that's been typed because we saw a packet, you know, or something like that. So that's pretty far-fetched stuff. That's you know, NSA spook territory, you know, type things. But not as far as I know. Like the opportunities to attack it would be on the endpoints, on within the Bluetooth stack or driver framework on the client or the system that the Bluetooth device is connected to, or within the Bluetooth device itself.
All right. Hey, let's talk about your Bluetooth war driving rig, because I'm told it's quite something.
It is something, that's for sure. It's based on I'm using the parallel scanning attack that Ollie Whitehouse and some other people from at stake developed a number of years ago. But it's just this god awful rig of a couple of it's 3 7-port USB hubs with a number of Class 1 Bluetooth devices in it, all doing parallel address scanning. So whenever you have Bluetooth devices that are discoverable, you can easily find those. That's meant to happen. What this attempts to do is by searching the hardware address space that represents the Bluetooth devices at that level, it attempts to locate devices. Now, searching, you know, all away from, you know, 00000000000 to FFFFFF, so on, takes a long time, but we don't actually have to do that hard work. We just narrow it down to the manufacturer IDs that are known for a lot of devices, and this is information that's published as part of just registered numbers on the internet, because manufacturers have to have these things assigned to them. And basically, you can take that and just feed it into this little system, and then it sort of goes sick on scanning those things, and will eventually find devices that are in operation. Now, they don't have to be discoverable; they just have to be on. And this is where the fundamental way to protect yourself with Bluetooth is to turn it off when you're not using it. Coming back to that, but it's you know, again, that's just something that's difficult to communicate to users that Bluetooth should be turned off, and when they're not using it. And part of it's just the fact that, you know, even for myself, you know, reminding myself to turn it on and off and turn it on and off and turn it on and off as I use it is difficult, especially where, you know, I'm a Mac user. I don't have the nice little switch on it that a lot of Intel-based, like PC-style notebooks actually do have, to allow us to easily see the big blue light that wireless is on or off or whatever. And it's something that is a big, it's hard to expect users to do. Now, the big sinister issue for me is not even when we have something that's a low-level attack like this Microsoft vulnerability, but just the ability from operating systems like Windows XP and Mac OS 10 to support PAN access. So basically, they'll use an equivalent concept of kind of the internet connection sharing thing to share your 802.11 or Ethernet on your notebook with Bluetooth devices that are connecting to it, and to the network that's connected to. It just looks like it's the notebook. It doesn't look like it's the Bluetooth device, because it's effectively NATing for that, and that's something that's hard to police on the network. And if there's you allow users to actually configure and pair Bluetooth devices and to configure their operation, we're probably extending the network a lot further than we think. And I've found on many occasions when reviewing the build of a notebook SOE for an enterprise that in addition to using Bluetooth for you know, PIM access to synchronize my phone and things like that. I can, you know, I can also use it for, you know, to get it effectively an IP address on the Bluetooth device, and off I go. Now, you know, that's okay, I guess, if that's me, but what if it's someone else? So, you know, it's...
Now, just going back to your Bluetooth rig,
yeah,
you were saying that it's, you know, this you were using it with a variation of Ollie Whitehouse's attack. What does that attack actually enable you to do? So when you go war driving with this amazing Bluetooth rig, what sort of mayhem can you cause?
The only mayhem I cause is in my mind, my little sinister plans. What I can do is just go off looking for devices that aren't discoverable. So they're on, and because the users haven't turned them off, and I can find them. Now, what I could theoretically do at that point, and it's theoretical because I don't do this, is that when a device is discoverable, you can learn a lot more information about what services it wants to support for a remote device that potentially pairs with it. So part of the announcement that it sends out and being discoverable is saying that, you know, I'm this sort of device and I support these sort of things. So I'm a car adapter kit, and so I want to work with a headset and handset profile, for example, or I'm a computer and I support PAN, which is the remote networking function, and I support headset and handset profile and these and synchronization things and so on. So it basically allows you to do a bit of enumeration on what sort of device it is. And in theory, what you could do is you use this to find devices that, you know, have been in use for Bluetooth but aren't sitting there discoverable because either the manufacturer or the user has provided some sensible, you know, control in their own right by turning it off, the discoverability part of it. But basically, from that point, then you could start looking at doing the Allbex attacks or looking at doing, attacks on specific types of phones. Like there's attacks on like that are specific to Motorola phones, the Hello Moto attack that the guys from Trifonite did, which is another, they did another distance-based attack that they demonstrated where they were enumerating a phone with particular vulnerabilities over a significantly long distance by, you know, modifying a Class 1 USB Bluetooth device and putting a directional antenna on it, which is not unlike what I'm doing with my rig. My rig is, it's three off-the-shelf USB hubs chained into another USB hub, connected into a system, and then a whole bunch of cheap of Class 1 Bluetooth devices that I'm actually afraid to operate in the same room as myself because they're so poorly manufactured.
Have you invested in the lead underwear, mate?
I've actually been wondering about that. You know, I don't have children yet, and I'm wondering if my RF enthusiasm will make that difficult at any point.
So. I don't think you'll have any trouble. You're just going to have daughters.
That's
the rule. That's ask any radar technician. That's how it works.
Okay, because I thought that would just be karma for me to have daughters, but
karma, yeah. No pun intended.
Yes. Actually, yeah.
Now, speaking of karma, actually, you had a bit of a look into HD Moore. Of course, was on the show. What was that, last month or the month before? Talking about his evil EPC and the work he's done with karma, and this is more on the 802.11 front. And you say that there are a lot more things that you can do with 802.11 than you can do with Bluetooth.
Well, I feel that that's just a product of how both the two technologies kind of eventuated. That 802.11 was something that's come from a series of IEEE working groups, and whereas Bluetooth is more from an industry-based, this Bluetooth SIG, like the industry special interest group that has basically defined how Bluetooth should operate. So I feel that in some sense that, not kind of a closed source, open source thing, but there's been a different approach to the development of it. But what HD Moore had done with the extensions he done for Metasploit and then using the work by K2 and others in Karma, the HD Moore part of that I found really fascinating because he's taken basically the top 500 websites, the internet, and basically gets, after you join the fake network that looks like some open network that you've known in the past, it nudges your browser, for example, on the web attack part of it through all these different sites, and you just give up all your cookies to it. I took the opportunity to, I just went ahead and took every workstation in the house and ran it through it just because I thought it'd be interesting to see what everything spills because as a tinfoil hat paranoid kind of guy, I thought I did a pretty good job of not saving caches, not saving cookies, not saving this. Well, there were, you know, little bits and pieces of things in there that I found really interesting that were, you know, revealed by this basically. And this is me doing it to myself. So, you know, obviously there's a greater opportunity to do it to the great unwashed, so to speak.
What did it cough up that surprised you?
They were just things that I really haven't looked at. There are certain sites, you know, that I trust and certain sites that I don't, just as part of, you know, doing my daily life things. And there are some really stupid things that some sites store in cookies. There are, you know, significant login detail information, personal details that I thought that they were storing on their site and just presenting after I authenticated. No, it's coming from my cookies. So
great.
Yeah. So. And it's I don't want to name any sites, but some very large financial sites, some very large e-tailers that should know better, I think. And for that matter, I should have too. So now I'm even more stripped down as far as keeping that stuff, and that means that, you know, I have to continually have to go back to my password keepers and things like that.
So you're telling me that we found something that made Neil Wise more paranoid?
Yeah.
That's amazing. I didn't think it was possible, but we've done
it. I didn't think so either, but, you know, and eventually, whenever I'm wearing my entire lead suit, then, yeah.
Assurance.com.au's Neil Wise there on the line from Melbourne. Next week, you'll hear part two of that interview, where we'll talk wireless compliance disasters, 802.1x, 802.11 adoption headaches, and much, much more. Now, Checkpoint Software is one of our dear beloved sponsors. And without sponsors like Checkpoint, we can't do Risky Business and bring it to you every week. So each week we like to have our sponsor on the show as a way of saying thank you. That's our quid pro quo anyway. So this week's sponsor interview is with Checkpoint's Asia Pacific Engineering Manager, Steve McDonald. And he says customers out there in enterprise land are starting to demand always on VPNs. So what the hell do you do with all of these endpoints that want to be automagically and permanently connected to the corporate LAN?
People want convenience with computing now. They don't want to have to unpeel the onion every time they jump on board by getting a laptop out, turning it on, logging on, connecting a network, connecting an application, and then connecting a VPN. People are just expecting it all to work like a BlackBerry and out of the box, and obviously there are security considerations that come with that.
You know, it is sort of early days, isn't it, in terms of the adoption of always-on VPN, and that's probably going to create some unforeseen headaches, you'd imagine.
Yeah, look, Checkpoint, along with most of the other vendors, have had some degree of capability in this area for years now. And it's been something that you might have done with ATMs running Windows code or something along those lines to help secure those up by providing endpoint security and VPN. But over the last couple of weeks, I've noticed a distinct change in a lot of our customers out there on the coalface. They're actually starting to look at this and getting requests from senior management to look into the viability and fortunately, they're stopping and considering the ramifications.
Well, site-to-site VPN has always been fixed, you know. Like, there's no big deal there because you're going to watch your production environment and, you know, whereas, yeah, once you start bringing endpoints into the equation, you've got that whole problem with malware on an uncontrolled endpoint.
You're right. And when I walked through AusCert, and it was good to see you up there, just walking around, looking at the amount of people in the common areas there who had laptops open where you could certainly see what was on their screen as you walked past. But then if you imagine what you can do with your fingers and a keyboard as you walk around the floor there. And you've got to start looking at new ways that businesses are communicating. Well, not so new, but instant messenger in the enterprise is a reality by various providers now. It's been the case the same time for years. And people want that to be available when they're traveling around, when they're outside the workplace, and that's where some of the drivers for this automatic and auto and always connected VPN come from.
Well, I've got to tell you something really funny that happened at AusCert, which is a friend of mine was doing some passive sniffing, right, on the wireless network at AusCert, which is, you know, what you do. But he actually picked up some traffic that was going to a domain name called hog.ru, which you can imagine is probably the destination for some sort of keylogger, right? Now, what was interesting is it was actually hitting 0-byte GIFs every, like, you know, 200 milliseconds or something. So it was obviously every single keystroke that someone was hitting a different 0-byte GIF as a HTTP request onto hog.ru. So, man, I mean, that's case in point, isn't it? That endpoints are, to use a pun, a risky business.
Well, if we as an industry and industry professionals can't seem to get a grasp on this, then we need to look at the enterprises and certainly see what we can do about helping them through this process. And it's not just one or two things you need to do on the enterprise, but it's a unified approach that you need. You need obviously the antivirus components. You need anti-spyware. You need personal firewalling. You need device control. You need port control, Bluetooth control, Ethernet control, wireless control. All these different elements start adding up to a bit of a nightmare when you're trying to look after that for an enterprise.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that's the, standard security headache that you've just outlined. But So, Steve, do you think there's a possibility that this always-on VPN thing, which seemed like a good idea at the time, do you think it's something that we could plunge headlong into and then roll back from? Because it's just, you know, we know that convenience and security are not always compatible concepts.
Yeah, look, there's something that's going to confuse that a little bit further in that always-on VPN is a requirement when you start talking about being able to do seamless transitioning between networks. So once I'm connected, remain connected, regardless of which network I'm connecting via, you know, a next-G network or a wireless network. And the ability to transition those seamlessly from both a cost and a speed perspective is important to a lot of users. And that's where a lot of that capability comes from. So we might end up with it without actually wanting it. And once it's there, people may start using it.
Well, keeping that secure is going to be an absolute nightmare as well, doing that sort of hopping things. I mean, there's going to be authentication challenges galore there.
Well, once again, the VPN shouldn't necessarily need to renegotiate much at all. Typically, if we're talking about an SSL VPN, it'll handle the changeover quite happily. If we're doing some degree of token-based authentication, we should have a token that we can take across to the new IP addressing combinations and continue without a hiccup. And we've got that capability in the SSL products today.
So it almost sounds a little bit like the sort of challenges that went through the thin client, quote-unquote, industry a few years ago. I remember when Citrix were talking about stuff like this, when, you know, Road Warriors, a good way to provision access to Road Warriors was to use stuff like application gateways, like Citrix Metaframe. I know you guys have got one as well. But it really does sound like, yeah, it's going through that same thing, but using your own applications instead of a thin client to served applications.
Yeah, absolutely, and as you said before, this is going to be a hard one. Once the lion has rushed out of the pen, in this case, it's going to be hard to regain control, whether or not we're talking about thin or thick client or rich client functionality, because once users have got that type of capability and become familiar with it, they really, it's hard to get them to relinquish it.
So, Steve, just before we go, mate, I remember that the last time you were on Risky Business, you happened to very subtly mention that the full disk encryption product for Mac, made by PointSec, which is, of course, you know, a part of Checkpoint now, that's actually available for download for customers. And now it's been, you know, officially launched and trumpeted and whatnot. How's that all going?
It's going really well, Patrick. We're getting a lot of interesting customers already starting to talk about it. And once again, going back to AusCert, you look at the amount of Macs that we're poking around up there by security professionals, and it's going to be those type of people that we're targeting first up with our product set. So we've had a lot of interest already.
Now, mate, just a housekeeping issue. You wanted to mention that you've got some customer events happening around Australia?
Yeah, we've got user and partner group sessions running in Australia and New Zealand over the next couple of weeks. We'd love to see all of our customers and partners along. Get in contact with your local Checkpoint rep.
Okay, Steve McDonald, thanks a lot for coming on to Risky Business again this week.
Patrick, thank you very much.
Listen to them lyrics, guys. Romance, romance is the thing. Why the woman roping, you know?
Checkpoint Software's Asia Pacific engineering manager, Steve McDonald there. Coincidentally, a former colleague of our earlier guest, Neil Wise. Small world. And that's it for this week's edition of Risky Business. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis from the wonderful world of IT security. This week's Sound Foundation track is Two Stepper by King Tide, and you can buy it at soundfoundation.com.au for $1.40. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Gyal, the way them spinning up your woman roping, him back Beverly up in a Brisbane, Corral Kylie down in an Indian. We never see a man with so much romance. Whatever latch him turn is where him sleeping. It seems like the tide will never reach him. Watch the key step on how you playing now. Watch the key step on how you playing now. Watch the key step on how you playing now. Watch the key step on how you playing. Girl, the wedding spinning up your woman roping. Be settled with a lawyer named Jacqueline, who gave up her figure when she had wings for him. She looking for him, but in gone, Melvin. This time he rock up in that girl called Stacy, man. He looks Stacy, man. She pure sexy. Me wonder if he ride it like a racehorse jockey. Watch the key step on how you playing up. Watch the key step on how you playing up. Watch the key step on how you playing up. Watch the key step on how you playing up.
Caribbean. Romance is the thing. Why the woman roping, you know? Why we not the one magic man? It's my pipe for this, you know, man.
Long enough, time comes in. Rolls out again. Watch your two step in this world, girlfriend.
Listen.
You sit there long enough, time comes in.
Rolls out again. Why the woman roping, you know? Romance is the thing.
Watch your two step.
Why the woman roping, you know? Why I'm another one magic man, this man, five minutes, you know, man. Romance.